People love to solve mysteries. Some have spent years, probably a lifetime, trying to solve some conundrum or other. Well, the letter to the Hebrews presents to us a 2,000-year mystery. Who wrote it? When was it written? Where was it written? Well, we're left in a quandary on all those three issues. The 3rd century theologian, Origen, said this: who it was that wrote this epistle, God only knows. What we do know about this epistle is that it was written to Jewish believers who had come out of Judaism into Christianity. But in order to escape the persecution that they were now suffering, the temptation was there to go back into their old way of life under Judaism. And therefore, the writer of this letter is encouraging these young Christians not to go back, but to go on to perfection. Now, there are a number of words that you will find regularly through this epistle. The word better, the word perfect, the word heavenly. But there are 2 words that are used quite often through this letter. And those are the words that I want to just consider for a moment, especially as we enter into this year of 2016. They are the words, let us. Let us. Now, it's interesting to find when these 2 words were first used. And you go back to the book of Genesis and chapter 1. And in verse 26, we read, God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness. God the Father was there in the beginning. God the Son was there in the beginning. God the Holy Spirit was there in the beginning. They were in it together. Don't think the Conservative Party thought of that first. They were in it together. Now, I want to just look at 1 or 2 occasions when these 2 words were used. And what it's saying to us this morning as we enter 2016 as a church here at Hook. Now, the first time these words are used are in chapter 4 and verse 14. And it says this: let us hold firmly to the faith we profess. And I want to link that with chapter 10 and verse 23, where the writer says this: let us hold unswervingly to the hope that we profess. As I said, the writer is very conscious that young believers are facing severe persecution, and the temptation to return to life under Judaism is becoming so evident. This letter is to encourage them not to lose their hold on their new faith, the new faith that they have embraced and now professed. He's telling them to hold tight, to not lose their grip, to not slip from their newfound beliefs. It's interesting, he began this letter with that same exhortation. If you go back just to chapter 1, and I think it's important because here in chapter 1, the writer begins this letter by exalting our Lord Jesus Christ. In verse 1 of chapter 1, he reminds these young believers that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. He reminds them in verse 3 that he is our one and only mediator. He reminds them in verse 5 that Jesus is far better than the angels. He reminds them in verse 10 that Jesus is the eternal creator of the universe. He reminds them in verse 12 that Jesus Christ is the unchanging one, the one who was same yesterday, today, and will be forever. Then in chapter 2, verse 1, he says this: give your full attention to the things that you have heard, so that you do not drift away. That's right at the beginning of the letter. And now, as we move into chapter 4 and chapter 10, he's telling them to hold firmly and unswervingly to their faith, despite their difficult circumstances and the persecution that they're going through. Someone came up to me some time ago and asked me what were my encouragements over the years of ministry with Day One Christian Ministries. It was a pleasure to share some of the encouragements. And then they said this: what is your greatest disappointment? I said, I can't give you my greatest disappointment, but I will tell you one disappointment. It's when believers today lose their grip on the faith that they have embraced and now attempted to move in other directions. Once they walked with us, but now they no longer walk. I find that one of my greatest disappointments. My message to you today at Hook, at the very beginning of 2016, is simply this. The message is no different than 2,000 years ago. Whatever your circumstances now, whatever your circumstances may be in the future, hold fast to the faith that you profess without wavering. Don't let your grip remove. Don't let you slip from the faith that you have now embraced. The next time these words are used, I move into chapter 4 and verse 16. Says this: let us approach the throne of grace with confidence. Now, verse 14 of that same chapter reminds us that we have a great high priest who is seated at the right hand of the Father, and his name is Jesus. And he is the one who is only too well aware of the temptations we face day by day. Why is he aware? Because he's already faced them and endured. There's nothing that you will go through, nothing at all, that he hasn't already faced. He knows what it is to suffer. He knows what it is to face persecution. He knows what it is to be tempted. He's faced it and endured. And so, he invites us this morning to approach him, to bring our pain, our temptations, and our sufferings to him. He is only too willing to hear our cry, if only we were as eager to pray as he is to listen. What a difference it would make. We come as we are, and we come as often as we need, and we can lay our burdens right at his feet, small or great. He can handle them. God is big enough to handle any burden. Don't carry them yourself. Just lay them before him. There's an old hymn. I like some of the modern ones, but I still like some of the old ones. And there is an old hymn, and it goes like this. Oh, what peace we often forfeit. Oh, what needless pain we bear. Why? It's all because we do not carry everything to God in prayer. The writer of the Hebrews knew the importance of spending time with God. And so he encourages these believers to approach the throne of grace, not timidly, but with total confidence. Now, there's not much that we can be confident about in the world today. Very little. But one thing that we can be confident about is that God hears our prayers. Therefore, let's approach him with total confidence. The third time that we come across these words, let us, we have them in a small cluster. But before we consider them, I want us to turn to chapter 11 and just the last part of chapter 11. The writer in this chapter goes back to the very dawn of history. He lists the giants of our faith, both men and women, who have overcome despite all the difficulties that they face. And then he closes chapter 11 with these words, 39 and 40. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. God had planned and provided something better for us so that only together with us would they be made perfect. You know, we read these words so quickly and so glibly. What's this saying to us? It's saying that these great giants of the faith that we've read about in chapter 11 have still not received the promise. They've still not been made perfect. Why? Because they're waiting for people like you and me. Because we're all in it together. The amazing thing to me is that people like me and you are included in this great company of people. And we are going to inherit a great kingdom with them. I feel so unworthy of even being linked with them. But the inspired writer assures us that we are. And then as we come into chapter 12, we have the cluster. It says this, verse 1, as we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders us and the sin that so easily entangles us. And these words are really conveying to us that we're not in a spiritual sprint, we're in a spiritual marathon. And at the end, there's a precious prize to claim. Now, I'm sure that all of you are aware of the many gold medals that Yorkshire won for the country in the 2012 Olympics. I'm just passing on facts, that's all. Please, don't think anything else. And in case you're worried, don't worry, because we've got it all sorted out at Rio as well, and we'll do the same for the country. We like to help you along. But look, I remember just watching one particular event, and that was the triathlon. And I remember watching the two Brownlee brothers, Alistair and Jonathan. And I remember watching Alistair in particular, as at the end of this triathlon, he made his way to the finishing line. And I saw the determination on his face. I saw the commitment on his face. He'd trained for years to obtain the prize. And nothing was going to stop that prize being his. Have you ever seen an Olympic athlete run who's overweight, wearing boots, trousers, heavy jumper, carrying an umbrella just in case it rains? Of course you haven't. One thing that any Olympic athlete will do is to run with as minimum of weight as possible. They want nothing at all to hinder them in attaining the prize that they've trained years to attain. Look, friends, we are in a spiritual marathon. It's not a sprint. And we too are to throw off, chuck away, cast aside any sin that hinders us or burdens us. Can I ask you, as you enter 2:16, do you find sin a problem? Or is it something that just doesn't bother you too much? I tell you this, friends, and I'll be honest, sin is a problem for me as soon as I wake up, and with me right until I get to bed. It's a challenge every day, and we're to throw it off. We're to cast it aside. We're to run free from the burden of sin that so often drags us down and that holds us back. But let's look at the second in that cluster, because it's still in verse 1. It says, let us run with perseverance, with patience, the race that is marked out for us. Do you remember when you were at school and you took part in the cross country? Did you ever get a stitch? Did you have legs that felt as heavy as lead as you plodded through the mud? Did you ever feel like giving up or finding a shortcut or, worse still, letting everyone pass you and then thumbing a lift back to school? Yeah, you probably thought about it. But you knew the teacher was behind one of these trees or one of these hedges, just keeping us an eye on all that was happening. So what do? You battle through the pain barrier. You battle through the difficult conditions. You kept to the rules. Look, the Christian life can be very painful at times. I have no sympathy whatsoever with some of these preachers and evangelists who say, look, you come to Jesus and everything's going to be fine. All your problems will be solved. All your difficulties will be over. I find that nowhere in the Bible. Nowhere at all. In fact, what I find is that probably your problems will be greater. The Christian life can be painful. You can be let down by people. You can face times of sickness and adversity, sometimes severe. People you trusted disappoint you. And life sometimes feels so unfair. Let me just say this to you. When God puts his children into the furnace, he keeps his hand on the thermostat and he keeps his eye on the thermometer. Just remember that. We will not be tempted more than we can be able to bear. as the temperature will drop. And he is watching the thermostat. No, friends, when difficulties come your way, you don't chuck in the towel. You press on. You persevere. You endure to the end, knowing that an unseen God is upholding you and supporting you right to the very end of the marathon. And also remember that many of life's failures are people who did not realize how close they were to success when they gave up. So my message to you in 2016, as individuals and as a fellowship, is this. Keep running. Don't give up. Persevere to the very end. Now, there's a third in that cluster of letters. It's in the same chapter and it's in verse 2. And it says this. Let us fix our eyes upon Jesus. A number of years ago, I came to retirement. And we had one little problem. We were living in a company house, and although we were told we could stay in that house, we just felt that the society may need it, may require it, and we decided to move out. We didn't know where we were going to go initially. We thought of a number of things, and then our son and daughter-in-law came to us and said, Dad, what are you doing when you retire? Where are you going to live? And I said, Mark, I ain't a clue. He says, well, we've been thinking about it. And we've got a kind of a building that's derelict in the garden. And, yeah, I know what you're thinking. And we could turn it into a one-bedroom bungalow. I said, look, Mark, two things. I appreciate the thought, but you're not going to have two older people hanging around you for the part of your life. You've got three grandchildren, you've got three children, you've got enough to occupy yourself, you're running the company. No, Mark, we'll find a way out. And then I'll remember, as though it was yesterday, Mark coming up to me and saying, Dad, you've looked after us. If we now can't look after you, we'd class that as an insult. You see, he comes from Yorkshire as well. So it kind of hit us. And we said, okay. And so they converted this building into a one-bedroom bungalow. We've been there now for about 6 years and we love it. Then Mark said to me, Dad, I know that you love vegetable gardening. Around the bungalow, there's meadowland. And there's been meadowland for hundreds of years. Now take what you want and grow vegetables. And just remember that we're only 50 yards away. So I remember started digging this meadowland. I wanted about 11 plots for different vegetables. And I started digging. Oh, it was so hard. It was like rock. It was full of stones. And I heard the whispers that were going around. He won't do it. He'll give up. Even my wife. He'll give up. He won't do it. And you know, when I heard these whispers, it made me even more determined to carry on. So I dug the beds and I eventually cleared the stones and I eventually got vegetable seeds in and eventually enjoyed the crops. Now, what kept me going when it was so hard and so difficult? Well, number one, a determination not to give in. Number two, prove my family totally wrong, including my wife. But three, the end product on my dinner plate. Look, why do we keep persevering when the Christian life at times can be so difficult? Why? The thought of what's at the end. The thought of seeing Jesus. Thought that one day we're going to cast our eyes upon the one who loved us, the one who gave himself for us, the one who bore God's wrath instead of us, the one who brought us into that great family of believers. To see him makes it all worthwhile. When the Apostle Paul wrote the closing words to Timothy in his second letter, he said this: I fought a good fight. I finished the race. I have kept the faith. Now there is a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day. I want to draw to a conclusion with just one illustration. Some of you may have heard of a man called Professor Werner Wright. Some of you may not. Professor Werner Wright was professor of rheumatology at Leeds University. He was also a medical advisor to the DHSS. Werner Wright was a wonderful Christian. He was one of the founding fathers of United Beach Mission and Young Life. And he was one of the vice presidents of our society. He was a good friend. Werner Wright came to the very close of his working life, and then he was diagnosed with a serious form of cancer. Friends went up to Werner and said, Werner, you've now got to slow down. You've now got to take your foot off the brake, off the accelerator and put it on the brake. You've got to start taking things steady. And Werner looked at his friends and he just said this: can you tell me what an athlete does when he's taken part in a marathon and he comes round that final bend and he sees the tape ahead and he sees the opposition right behind him? Can you tell me what that athlete does? Does he dawdle to the line? Does he stroll to the finish? No. When he sees the tape, he sprints for it. And if you think I'm going to dawdle my way to heaven, you have another thing coming. I can see the line and I'm sprinting for it. He spent his last days in a hospice in Harrogate. 2 days before he died, he had all the staff at the hospice around his bed. He could hardly talk. But he spent those last few moments telling the whole staff of the hospice about Jesus. He sprinted to the end. I remember my father always saying to me, son, it's far better to wear out than rust out. And I have to say this, there are a lot of Christians who are passengers, and there are a lot of Christians who are armchair Christians, and there are a lot of Christians who are rusting out. Don't be one of those. Jesus is worth wearing out for. Give your whole self to him as you start 2016. If there's things you've never done, well, this is a good time to start to do them. Be involved, be active. Because one day at the end, we're going to see Jesus. And that is the greatest prize of all. And just to look at him and to hear those words, "Well done," will mean everything. So we're in it together. We're not individuals. So let us labor together. Let us pray together. And let us bring glory to his name together.